Now 75 in both Racine and Kenosha, humidity 85%. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Music by the Lake, hosting Broadway television star and Tony Award-winning baritone Brian Stokes Mitchell with the celebrated Chicago Philharmonic on Saturday, August 10th in Williams Bay. In purchasing tickets online, go to musicbythelake.com and in the promo code bar, type WGTD10. For a special offer exclusive to WGTD listeners. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
Hear me now, thou bleak and unbearable world. Thou art base and debauched as can be. And the knight with his banners all bravely unfurled now hurls down his gauntlet to thee. I am I, Don Quixote, the Lord of La Mancha. My destiny calls and I go. And the wild winds of fortune will carry me onward, oh, whithersoever they blow. Whithersoever they blow. To glory I go.
And that magnificent voice and unmistakable artistry belong to Brian Stokes Mitchell. And it is certainly exciting to be welcoming Brian Stokes Mitchell not only back to the morning show, but more importantly, back to the Music by the Lake series in Lake Geneva. He will be performing there with the Chicago Philharmonic on Saturday night, August 10th. And ahead of that, I'm very, very happy to have the opportunity to reconnect with Brian Stokes Mitchell and talk a bit about his exciting, fascinating life and career and what people can expect from what promises to be a wonderful night of music making on August 10th. Brian Stokes Mitchell, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Greg, thank you. It's great being with you again. Thanks for having me.
It's just great to talk to somebody who is so renowned, and we have lots to talk about. I believe when we talked last, we did not talk very much about your childhood. And as I read up a bit more about you, it turns out that you had quite an interesting childhood, uncommon in that you, if I understand correctly, grew up on military bases because your father, who I think was a civilian, did work for the U.S. Navy. Tell us about this aspect of your childhood and the significance of it in terms of the ways in which that kind of childhood maybe shaped who you are.
Yeah, great questions. Thank you. It's interesting because, you know, I think when you're a kid and up until maybe your 20s, you think, oh, everybody has the same life, and you don't realize that your childhood or everybody's life is very unique. And mine certainly was as well. My father, as you said, was a civilian working for the Navy. I was born in Seattle. When we were six, we moved down to San Diego, but only for 9 months. Then he got transferred to Guam. So when I was 6 years old, we lived in Guam for 2 years. And then after that, we moved to Subic Bay in the Philippines, and I lived there for 6 years. So I didn't move back to the United States until I was about 14 years old, going into the ninth grade. And it was a really great place and a beautiful place. It's kind of like small town America growing up on a Navy base, except for you've got a jungle in your backyard and monkeys coming down and poisonous snakes in your house and things like that. I was a Boy Scout there, and I learned to make rice cookers and canteens with bamboo and all kinds of interesting things. I went on the Bataan Death March, which was a 50-mile hike that happened, it was commemorating the Death March from World War II as well. So I had lots of really interesting experiences. And I, on reflection, I realized that it prepared me perfectly for the life that I have now, because as a performer, as an actor, particularly on Broadway, but also in film and television as well, you get very close with a bunch of people very quickly. They become your family. You see them at their best. You see them at their worst. And then at some point, it's all over, and you're gone, and those people are gone, and you may or may not ever see them again. And that was very much what my childhood was like, with people coming in from different parts of the United States to the Navy bases. And some of them I have seen and kept up with, and most of them I have not. So I guess I had to be an actor. That and being born on Halloween, which is, the day people dress up and pretend to be other people. What else could I have done with my life?
Right. For as fascinating as that life was, you probably didn't have a whole lot of opportunity for, piano lessons and summer plays and that sort of thing. Opportunities that would be more sort of easily available for somebody living a more ordinary childhood. Can I assume that your love of, for instance, theater and music came a little bit later once you had settled down back in the United States?
Well, yes, actually, the deep part of it, I would say, did. But my brother George, who's been a professional costume designer now all of his life, he was the first thespian in the family and started that actually in the Philippines.
Huh.
I was exposed actually to quite a bit of theater through the USO. And it was interesting because when I was in my mid-20s, I actually did a USO tour. I've done two USO tours, and I went back to Subic Bay in the Philippines, which had not changed at all. There was still one light on the entire base. And I went back and I performed at the Station Theater, which is where I had seen probably, 50 USO shows. And I remember the very first musical I saw was A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which was Stephen Sondheim's show, of course. And I thought it was one of the funniest things that I'd ever seen in my life. I later found out that one of the cast members was Jeffrey Tambor in that show. Somebody sent me a picture of the cast that was from that company. And my brother George, because of his interest in theater, he was acting and doing community theater there and was kind of the high school star and the high school class president and everything as well. I'm the youngest, and he is the oldest boy in the family. Because of that, I was exposed through our stereo to all of these different musical theater composers, and he particularly loves Stephen Sondheim. So I heard a lot of his work when I was younger. So and the music part of it actually started on Guam. My parents say that I asked for an organ. I wanted to play the organ. I don't remember that or why, but they ended up getting me a fan organ, and immediately I was obsessed with the instrument, and I sat down with it, I would sit with it for hours and play with it and play with the notes and the tones. And I was fascinated by the way certain combinations of my fingers on the keys would not only sound, but more so would make me feel. And I think that was my first connection of how music can connect you to your emotions and give you joy and give you sadness and give you all of these different things through this kind of alchemy of sound.
Hmm. So when you were reaching, for instance, high school, It sounds like you were already very intent on a professional career in music or theater or both. Was that kind of a war within yourself in terms of where you wanted to focus your passions?
No, actually not so much, because music was always my place in the family. My next oldest brother, John, was also involved in theater, and my sister, Lorna, who was the oldest of all the kids, she was the first musician in the family. So what happened was when we moved back to the United States, all of a sudden I found myself in a high school. My brother George was graduated. My sister was out of the house at that point. She was the oldest, as I said. And my brother John was in a high school. And they asked me, do you want to take chorus or band or drama? And I was so tired of taking chorus and band because that's what I took every year. And I thought, well, there's no more fraternal competition. Let me try drama. And I took my first acting class in ninth grade in Kathleen Lund's ninth grade class. And the very first scene I ever did was, this occurred to me much later, was Good Morrow, Kate, for That's Your Name, I Hear, which was, of course, from The Taming of the Shrew. And that later occurred to me when I was sitting in the theater at the Martin Beck Theater right after I had won my Tony, and a bunch of young people came in and they were doing scenes from The Taming of the Shrew, and I saw some young 14-year-old young man come in and do that scene, and it hit me, oh my God, that was the very first scene I ever did in acting class, and here I am now sitting in a Broadway theater. Having just won a Tony Award for that, just the amazing, you know, circles that life makes. But when I was in San Diego, my father worked at that time he retired from the Navy and ended up working for Scripps Institute of Oceanography, and I had this great fascination, as I still do, with science and particularly marine biology. So I was thinking of being a marine biologist, but still, every day I was playing the piano or the organ. I was very obsessed by it, and I was starting to teach myself orchestration and arranging as well. And I had also grown up kind of with a tape recorder, a studio in my house, because my father was an electronics engineer. So we would always get the old tape recorder, and when he upgraded, and my brother John and I used to play for hours recording and making radio shows and making music on these things. So it was kind of a natural extension, but I really wasn't thinking about it professionally until probably around the 11th or 12th grade. I started actually working professionally in San Diego in the theater at the Old Globe and the San Diego Civic Light Opera. And also I was in a group called The Bright Side, which was like the Young Americans, which traveled every place performing, and those were my jobs actually then, and I think that's when I realized, oh, maybe I have something here. Maybe there's some kind of, you know, a promising future. Maybe not. Who knows?
Of course, the world now knows you for the amazing performances that you have delivered, particularly on the Broadway stage and in an array of marvelous shows. But your very first splash, in terms of nationwide recognition, came with your delightful work on a little TV show called Trapper John M.D. And I should mention before I forget, you're actually the second member of that cast that I have interviewed on this program. More than 30 years ago, I interviewed Charles Siebert because he was born and raised right here in Kenosha, Wisconsin, where our radio station is located. And
you know what? I forgot about that. Charlie Siebert and I still keep in touch. I just love him. I learned so much from him during Trapper John, and I'm sure I stole a lot from him as well because he had incredible comedic technique. And I forgot that he was from Kenosha. My wife, by the way, I think we might have talked about, is from Milwaukee. So I spent lots of time in Wisconsin. I have these constant connections up there, which is really nice. So that's fantastic.
But great.
Trapper John kind of put me on the national map. But it was interesting. People didn't realize that I was musical on that show. And I kind of kept that hidden because I was raised in musical theater and I always sang. But I actually made a conscious choice not to sing on the show, even if they asked me or even make any overtures that I would like to do that, because I kind of wanted to keep some some secrets and some things, you know, that I could reveal later. What I did do on that show, which was wonderful, I started studying through UCLA film scoring, conducting, orchestration, and arranging. And I ended up scoring a number of the shows on Trapper John because it's something that I've always been fascinated with. And so that was my first opportunity to do that. And it was just a magical time in my life because the producers, Don Brinkley and Frank Glicksman, loved Broadway people. So we had lots of Broadway folks that I had been listening to on these albums from my childhood coming into my living room, so to speak. And I got to meet, you know, and talk to them, Roddy McDowell and Rita Moreno and Celeste Holm and all kinds of other stars as well. So it was a really great learning experience for me.
Wow. I'm so glad you said that, because one of my questions was going to be something to the effect that how in the world did you go on to do what you did on Broadway, given the fact that I mean, this what you did on this television show, which was a rather lighthearted, lovely show, certainly not a heavy drama. And your character specifically was not given to heavy dramatic moments. Watching that, we would never imagine what you would go on to do, and I would never have imagined any kind of connection. It's like two different careers, almost two different lives.
Yeah, that's why I do call that. It was like a lifetime ago, but I always had it in my head that I wanted to do theater. And it's interesting because I was making observations while I was doing the show, and one of the things that I did observe was from other friends and people that had gotten off of television shows at the time that they couldn't get arrested after that. One of the downsides of being on a television series, especially one that runs a long time, is that people see you every week. You're in their living room, sometimes more than that if they're reruns, and they become kind of weary, and they think they know you and know everything that you do. And I knew I had some surprises in my back pocket, but after Trapper John, I could hardly get arrested because everybody wanted the new shiny toy, of course, and I wasn't that anymore. So I ended up going into voiceover work. I went into a lot of animated voiceover work, which I still do. And then I thought, you know what, I want to do theater again. And there was an opportunity at the Pasadena Playhouse to get into a show called Mail, M-A-I-L, that ended up being a big hit there. I ended up getting the role, and that was my first Broadway show. That was the show that took me through the Kennedy Center and then on to Broadway. But we only ran 2 months. But it was my entree, and I won what's called a Theater World Award, which is an award that's given every season to people making their Broadway debuts, about 20 people. And I didn't really understand the depth and wonderful nature of that gift when I received it. I found out later I was in incredible company with that. Just about anybody famous that's ever been on Broadway has received that award, and I was one of the lucky ones to get it. And to this day, it is one of my favorite awards that I've ever won.
Hmm. We're speaking with Brian Stokes Mitchell, and he is going to be appearing with the Chicago Philharmonic in the Music by the Lake series in Lake Geneva on Saturday evening, August 10th, and it is a real privilege to have him on the morning show today to talk about his great career. Your hallmark in terms of the amazing work you have done on Broadway has been a really interesting mix of some shows that have been just wall-to-wall bubbly fun, coupled with other works that have been much more wrenching and intense. And I suspect that that's one of the things that makes a career on Broadway such a rich experience, is the fact that you get to, in a sense, explore and experience such wide variation of emotional life.
Absolutely. It's one of the things that I've loved the most about it, is it's giving me this great opportunity to explore all of these different human beings. And that's kind of what you get to do as a performer. As a child, I remember I had a term for it, but maybe from the time I was 6 or 7 years old, I used to look at people and watch people, and I wished I could my term was blow myself into them and feel what it felt like to be them. Did it feel the same to walk for them that it does for me? Do they see colors the same way that I do? Do they hear sounds the same way that I do? You know, what does it feel like to be them? And, of course, I could never do that, but what I realized is much later on in my life, that's what I end up doing as an actor. I kind of blow myself into these different people and these different personas and with these different walks of life and points of view. And it's very eye-opening to be, I think, an artist and particularly a performer because, you know, that saying of walking a 1,000 miles in someone else's shoes, in a sense, as a performer, you get to do that. You have to fall in love with the person, whoever it is that you're playing, whether they're, you know, a darker kind of soul, like in Kiss of the Spider Woman or Jelly's Last Jam, or even in Ragtime, where Colehouse Walker ends up going, or King Headley, the August Wilson play that I did, or whether they're somebody lighter like Fred Graham in Kiss Me, Kate, you know, or Don Quixote in Man of La Mancha. But you get to explore all of these different personas, and I think it's really wonderful because it allows anybody, and you don't even have to do this professionally. You can do this in your community theater, in your high school. It's why I think arts are so important in school, particularly, is it allows people to see something greater than themselves, to realize there's more than themselves, and it gives people a great sense of empathy and understanding, and you kind of embrace your life, and you understand how you're different, how you're the same as everybody else, and kind of what connects us all, and that continues to be what I love to do, not only with films and television and Broadway, but also in my concerts as well. I kind of like to embody these different characters from the songs that I'm singing.
By the way, I wonder what it is. How is it a different experience to, for instance, be a part of something brand new exploding on the scene like Ragtime in 1998 versus bringing to the public a show that they already know like Kiss Me, Kate, for which you won the Tony, or something like Sweeney Todd or South Pacific, when you are in a sense treading in the shoes of those who have gone before you in that show, in that very role which you are now performing. How different are those two experiences or undertakings for you?
Well, there are a lot of differences, but a lot of similarities as well. The main difference is, of course, is you're creating something from scratch that nobody has seen before. They may have experienced it in a book or in a film, but especially in a musical, that's a very different kind of art form. So you get to define what this character is going to look like, walk like, sound like, as opposed to doing something like Kiss Me, Kate or Man of La Mancha. The audience has an idea of what these songs are already, the idea of what the show is, and what happens with the show. So in that sense, you're trying to rediscover or actually discover new things about the character and about the songs. And also make that connection, because this is the most important thing, I think, for an actor, is you have to make a very personal connection to those characters. So even though I listened to the Richard Kiley album a lot when I heard Man of La Mancha, and Angelo Pinzo when I was listening to South Pacific when I was younger, and I stole a lot from those guys, by the way, in their technique, because they're big baritones as well. When you finally get a hold of those roles to play on your own, you have to find a personal connection. What makes me respond to this person? What would I do in that situation? And also, I made a very conscious effort when I approached the song The Impossible Dream, for instance, to do it differently, because that song is one of the most beloved songs in the world. Mitch Lee, who wrote the music for it, told me that when he goes to Germany, or when he went to Germany, he's since passed away, and performed that song, the Germans would come up to him after the show and say, "Oh, thank you for writing The Impossible Dream. That's so German." And he'd go to Japan, and the Japanese would say, "Oh, thank you for writing The Impossible Dream. It's such a Japanese song." And it's the hallmark of a great song is a song that everybody can relate to like that. And so what I wanted to do is discover what's going to be different for me in that song. And I decided to tread in what I call the spaces of the material, as opposed to Richard Kiley sang these long, to dream the impossible dream, you know, these long phrases. And I thought, let me pull that apart a little bit, because that song is more, for me, a question and answer, you know. The question is, to dream what? Answer, the impossible dream. To fight who? The unbeatable foe. So there was this implied question in the spaces, and I thought, let me put a little space in there. And it kind of allowed me to rediscover and invent the song. So that's what you try to do when you're doing a new role as well, I think.
I love that. What is it like for you to step on the concert stage where you are, in a sense, shorn of the trappings of a full-staged production? No set, no costumes, and in most cases, no castmates. and in what way is that an experience that feels like less than something and maybe at the same time more than something?
Yeah, I have to say, I think if I had to pick one thing to do of all the things that I've done, television, film, voiceovers, all of that, Broadway, it would probably be concerts. It's what I love the best. Yeah, it almost feels like everything that I've ever done and been trained to do feeds best into the concert world. And I love it because, for one thing, it's always different. Every audience is different. Sometimes I do a concert with an orchestra, sometimes like I'm doing with the Chicago Philharmonic, a fantastic orchestra, by the way. I'm so looking forward to working with them again, or playing with them again, as I like to say. Sometimes it's with a jazz band. Sometimes it's with a trio. You know, sometimes it's just with a solo piano. And it's always different, and every audience is different, and it's one of the things that I love about the theater. But unlike the theater where you're doing 8 shows a week, it's the same show every time, and you're exploring the spaces. I can change the show up as much as I want. I can throw in different songs. I'm working on a new album now called Plays with Music that's going to be released in this fall. And so I'm introducing many of those songs in the concert as well. And you have a kind of different way to play with it. And because it is just me, I have all kinds of freedom. I can say what I want. If something just pops into my head, if something happened during the day, I like to make storytelling a part of it as well, because what I want people to be left with, and this is largely in my control when I'm doing a concert like this, I want them to feel happier, more joyful leaving than they did when they came in. For me, the theater in general and the arts in general, but particularly the theater and concerts, for me, are kind of like a church. And I feel like a good church, when you go to church, you should leave church feeling much better than you did when you walked in. More hopeful, more joyful, more excited, more empathetic, more connected, more yourself, more curious, more all of those things. And that's one of the things that I try to connect people with, because I like to connect with those things. And I think sometimes for those that want to go there with you, when you bring that energy onto the stage, it's kind of a contagious energy that hits the audience as well. And it becomes this wonderful synergistic kind of energy exchange that happens between the audience and not only me, but the orchestra and the conductor and the people on stage as well. And it's just it's a wonderful way to make a living. I feel like the luckiest human being in the world.
Right. Well, I felt very lucky to be in the audience for your concert in Lake Geneva 9 years ago. And I wonder if you could just take a second to tell our listeners about maybe a couple of high points that are going to be part of the concert on August 10th.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the first high point, of course, is being able to perform with the Chicago Philharmonic. Scott Speck is conducting this particular concert. And just to be able to sing with an orchestra and all of the colors and range that they bring to to the evening is a wonderful thing. And in this concert, I'm kind of mixing favorites up, familiar songs, as some songs that I've done from other albums. You know, I'll be doing I, Don Quixote, and most likely Impossible Dream from Man of La Mancha. And I'll be doing some other songs from older albums. But I'm also doing some of the songs that I'm doing on from my new album, Plays with Music, which is largely a symphonic album anyway. From that, I'll be doing Getting Married Today, which is kind of a crazy tune because I actually sing all of the roles in that, and it's a very fast patter song. I also do The Man I Love, which is interesting. I did it at a show originally called Broadway Backwards here in New York, where men sing women's tunes and women sing men's tunes, and I fell so in love with that song. And it's one of the ones that just gets a wonderful crowd response that I'm going to do that. And there's a new song that I started doing called Wizard Every Day, which is written by two young songwriters, and Nico Benson and Elizabeth Suggs are their name. And it's kind of a Halloween song, which is one of the reasons I was attracted to it since I was born on Halloween. But it's like any really great song, it's more than that. I get callings for songs, or they call me when I hear a song. Immediately a song would hit me. Impossible Dream was like that. What a Wonderful World, which I'll also be doing probably at the concert, is one of those songs. There's certain songs that just hit you immediately, and this was one of those songs, and it's just a really beautiful, beautiful song. It's funny, and it's heartwarming, and so I can't wait to hear what happens with those songwriters as well. But it's going to be a feel-good concert, basically, and I hope that people are going to be really happy that they came. I know that I'll be happy that I came.
Well, I am delighted to hear of your excitement, and I know a lot of other people are really excited to be in the audience to experience what you have to share on August 10th. Brian Stokes Mitchell, it's been a great pleasure and honor to speak with you again. Thank you so much, and very, very best wishes to you, and thank you for all that you've given the world with your artistry.
Oh, Greg, thank you so much for having me. Thanks for covering the arts, and you know, it's all of us working together that makes it happen. And I'm so excited once again to be on NPR. That's my go-to station all the time whenever I have a radio. So I'm just always happy to be a part of what you do as well. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Go out and tell our story. Let it echo far and wide. Make them hear you. Make them hear you. How justice was our battle, and how justice was denied. Make them hear you. Make them hear you. And say to those who blame us for the way we chose to fight, that sometimes there are battles that are more than black or white. And I could not put down my sword when justice was my right. Make them hear you. Go out and tell our story to your daughters and your sons. Make them hear you. Make them hear you. And tell them in our struggle we were not the only ones. Make them hear you. Make them hear you. Your sword can be a sermon or the power of the pen. Teach every child to raise his voice, and then my brothers, then will justice be demanded by 10 million righteous men. Make them hear you. When they hear you, I'll be near you again.
Yeah. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I am speaking for the next few minutes with Dara Lynn Weiss, who for a time was probably the most famous mother in America, thanks to an article which appeared in Vogue magazine about the struggles of her young daughter, who was termed obese by their pediatrician, and the struggle which the two of them had to bring her weight problem under control was chronicled in this very interesting and honest article, which unfortunately for Dara Lynn Weiss stirred up a huge amount of controversy and criticism. And hence the importance of telling her story in greater detail in a new book called The Heavy, A Mother, A Daughter, A Diet, a memoir by Dara Lynn Weiss, a freelance writer. And in this story, we hear about Dara Lynn Weiss and her daughter, B, and about this particular story, unique, of course, to this particular mother and daughter and small family, but a story which can be helpful for the rest of us as each of us confront this particular issue wherever we might be in our lives. But the fact that we are talking about confronting this issue with a young girl, of course, is what makes this a bit of a different story. And very, very helpful for us to consider. The book is published by Ballantine Books. And Dara Lynn Weiss, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Tell our listeners about the extent of your young daughter's weight problem. I mean, the point in time at which it became a serious issue and how serious it was.
Well, it's an interesting question because she didn't strike me as obese. It would not have occurred to me that she was in that category. She was obviously overweight, and she had been getting heavier and heavier with every passing year. But we went to the pediatrician every year, and it was always, you know, kind of take a wait-and-see attitude until it wasn't. And then I think that's something that probably a lot of parents of obese children don't kind of realize when that line has been crossed from just having a heavy kid who may well be healthy to having a child who is obese and whose weight is actually affecting their health. It was not something that was obvious to me that it had gotten to a point where we needed to intervene, but until the doctor told us.
Hmm. And you write in the book of how hearing that term obese was quite a difficult moment. I mean, that was a moment when you realized the seriousness of the situation. I mean, more so than if the doctor had framed it with different terminology.
Yes, and interestingly, you know, I became very interested in kind of where the cutoffs were and who had established those cutoffs and, how they worked. And indeed, you know, the 85th percentile for body mass index for age, which is the metric the Center for Disease Control uses to establish, you know, the kind of cutoffs for overweight and obese. The 85th percentile used to be called overweight, and now it's called obese for that very reason. They wanted to shock people into thinking about this as a medical emergency that needed intervention and not, you know, overweight, lots of us are overweight, and it doesn't have that same urgency. And I think that word had indeed the intended effect on me.
And so at what percentile for her age group was B?
She was at the 98th percentile.
Right, so she was way up the list, and you had just cause to be concerned. Of course, I suppose...
Right. Sorry, I might have... Let me... I don't know if I said 85th percentile is overweight. The 95th percentile is obese. I think I might have...
Right.
At obese at 85.
Yes.
It's actually obese at 95, and she was at 98.
Right. So you undertook a fairly aggressive regimen. I mean, I think you would be the first to say it, that you were intending to really take this seriously. And you said that one of the problems out there is that there is a difficulty in desiring to be thin versus being at a healthy weight. And that was one of the trickiest balancing acts through all of this, that you loved your daughter as she was, and it's not that you wanted her to be thin, but you wanted her to be at a healthy weight. Say a word about that tricky balancing act.
Well, I think it's tricky not just to convey that distinction to a child, but also to the people around you. When you kind of say, I'm helping my child lose weight, my child is on a diet, or, you know, working on her weight issue, I think the association is often that this is being done for aesthetic reasons, or that being thin is the goal. And I think it's so hard for a child who's just kind of beginning to be aware of all the body image pressures out there and the images that are being presented as kind of the ideal, and to kind of say, your weight is not healthy, we need to help you lose weight, but my goal is not to make you look like those girls on TV. I want you to just be healthy. It's very kind of tricky. And I was almost gratified that she was at such an age that, you know, after she attained a healthy weight, the goal then was for her to gain weight, you know, as she continues to grow, and that I was able to shift gears and say, now what's healthy for you is to gain weight, because I think it was scary for her at first, once she had reached a healthy weight, to see, as we kind of tracked her weight every week, that it was going up. And to kind of say, that's healthy for you. You know, we're not always trying to get the scale to go down. We're not trying to be thin. We're trying to be in a range that is healthy. And sometimes that will mean gaining weight, and sometimes that will mean losing weight. And trying to reinforce that it's unhealthy to be very thin, just as it is unhealthy to be very overweight. And it's very tricky. And I can't say that I've figured it out perfectly, but I try every day.
You also say that one of the most significant contributing factors to the fact that we have so many young children who are seriously overweight or perhaps even obese is what you call the national fear of telling overweight kids that they have a problem. You call that a huge contributor to the obesity epidemic. And I think maybe we have less reluctance about that now than we once did, but I know this is probably one of the reasons that your article in Vogue magazine attracted such attention, is that you were really trying to meet that reluctance head on.
Absolutely. You know, I read an article that said that of all the topics parents are uncomfortable discussing with their children, weight is number one, more than drugs and sex. And if you think about it, you know, we just sort of went through this with the drug wars with kids, that, you know, parents don't talk about drugs with their kids, the kids aren't going to know what their parents think or what their parents expect, or, you know, feel comfortable talking to their parents about their own feelings. And we're in that same position with weight. We're so concerned about saying the wrong thing, or, you know, blurring that line between health and aesthetics, that we don't say anything. And I think the clearest example of that was you know, the response that I've had of just parents that think, you know, why would you ever tell a 7-year-old girl she needs to lose weight? Why would you ever, you know, bring this topic up in such clear terms? And my approach was, if I don't, it's not going to help her. You know, this is, I should be as free to talk about this as any other medical issue. Let's look at it as a health concern and try to set aside those more, you know, aesthetic judgments we have about bodies that can make this issue so much more sensitive than it needs to be.
At several points in the book, you point out that this is something that really plays out in the public eye, unlike maybe other health issues or personal issues that, in a sense, can be and are, in fact, a little more private. Being mm-hmm. overweight is so blatant, so public, mm-hmm. you write at one point. And someplace mm-hmm. else you write, if all of B's meals had been prepared and served by me and eaten in private, our weight loss journey would have been a radically different experience. But food is public. Food is social. Ultimately, I was going to have to let B eat with and under the supervision of other people. And, of course, that was a source of great anxiety, particularly what she would be eating at school, what she would be eating with her friends. And mm-hmm. and this, of course, became one of the really toughest battles.
Yes, and, you know, there's been a lot of talk about my story and the issue of privacy and why am I being public about such a private issue. And I would argue that it's not really much of a private issue. Obesity is so obvious. You know, there's not a child suffering from it that isn't visibly suffering from it. And food is such a public and social aspect of our lives that to say this is only something that we're going to deal with privately can really sabotage efforts. To not feel comfortable discussing food choices, even curtailing, you know, food consumption in a public setting is almost impossible. And I think parents of healthy weight children do it all the time. And obviously that's part of parenting and that's supported. And to put obese children's parents in a position where they're scared to tell their child not to have a second piece of cake, as every other parent at the party is doing, or to kind of suggest a healthier meal option at a restaurant, as every other parent is doing, is doing them a great disservice.
Hmm. One of the most poignant moments in the whole book is at a point when your daughter is experiencing some success. I mean, a very slow start in the weight loss gauntlet, and then finally begins to show some significant success. But you tell us that, in fact, she did not appreciate it when people started commenting on how she had lost weight, how she was looking healthier. You write, B did not welcome all of this attention. To her, it was a reminder that she was not like everyone else. To her, someone commenting on her weight was an inherent reminder of the fat girl she used to be. And, of course, that is probably even tied up in the way in which her story was made public. That's not even really what you're talking about there. You're just talking about the appreciative, complimentary remarks of people in her own life. To this day, has B been able to kind of come to terms with that kind of attention, even if it's around a success, like managing to turn this serious weight issue around?
Well, I think as time goes by and she's sort of maintained a healthy weight, and it's the difference between the before and the after is kind of fading. It's just kind of who she is now. The comments have sort of evaporated, and I think she's grateful for that because it is awkward. You know, I think as an adult, we're thrilled when someone tells us that it looks like we lost weight. But for a kid, it is complicated, and I think it raises that interesting issue of thinness versus health. You know, to us, we wanted her to be healthy, and everyone was kind of congratulating her for being thinner, and that was kind of not the point, and I think it sort of reinforced this idea that, like, you didn't look good before, and now you do. And, you know, I think that's how she took it, as this kind of reminder, like, oh yeah, you were not in a good place before you took this weight off. And I think that was hard for her to hear, and I'm kind of grateful that now everyone's just used to her being, you know, at a healthy weight, and that it's not really a subject of note anymore.
Hmm. Ultimately, if this was about anything, this was about your efforts, in your words, to be kind to B while also being ruthless in my fight against her obesity. That balancing act between, and those are your own terms, between kindness and ruthlessness. Kindness towards your daughter, ruthlessness when it came to combating this very vexing and health-threatening problem. I mean, not an easy matter, nor an easy one to write about. And I really commend you for a job well done on both counts in your book, The Heavy, A Mother, Daughter, A Diet. It's published by Ballantine. Darlin Weiss, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, a preview of a marvelous American Experience documentary about Woodstock 50 years ago. And we'll be talking with somebody who attended Woodstock. That's tomorrow on the morning show, just after 8 o'clock. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Support for WGTD also comes from Music by the Lake, hosting Broadway television star and Tony Award-winning baritone Brian Stokes Mitchell with the celebrated Chicago Philharmonic on Saturday, August 10th in Williams Bay. Use code WGTD10.